Hello and welcome to the LGC News Roundup, the new podcast from the Local Government Chronicles news team, looking at the biggest and most significant stories of the week for councils. I'm Martin George, I'm Deputy Editor of the LGC, and today I'm joined by Megan Kenyon, our reporter, to have a chat about what's been happening this week in local government and, let's be honest, sexual government. Megan, we have what we think is the first local government minister for a very long time to become Prime Minister. Does that mean all the sector's problems are solved?
Well, I don't think so. but no, it is exciting news that Rishi Sunak is, I think he is the first Prime Minister to be a former local government minister, but not the first leader of the Conservative Party, because Michael Howard was actually a former local government minister as well. I think the kind of sense on the ground that I've got from speaking to councillors this week is they're quite pleased that Rishi Sunak is Prime Minister, purely because he has that local government experience, which I think they think is really important and shows that he has an understanding of how local government works and particularly local government finance. So I think that was greeted quite positively. And yeah, no, it's been a very hectic week, but I'm kind of glad we've got a bit of certainty on who's going to be leading us now. So
I think certainty, if nothing else, will always be welcomed by the sector, won't it? A retread. We have Michael Gove back as if he'd never left DLUC.
Michael Gove has returned as Levelling Up Secretary, which was announced quite late, on Tuesday. I was working later than usual waiting for it, but no, I think again that was very much welcomed by the sector in a sense of continuity. I think I spoke to Izzy Seccombe, the leader of the Conservative group at the LGA, and she said that this is great news as they've the sector's worked with Michael Gove before, so he knows what their asks are, but they're able now to reiterate those. And you know, he did a lot of work on Levelling Up. He released the Levelling Up white paper and on devolution and fine-tuning that framework that we've now got. So yeah, I think we're in a different economic situation now, so that may change things, but I think definitely that continuity has been very much welcomed by the sector after sort of a few months of a bit of chaos, really.
I read your story about your reaction to Michael Gove coming back to office. And every time we do one of these stories, a new Secretary of State, the sector always welcomes them. They look forward to a positive, constructive relationship.
Yeah.
They're never going to say otherwise. I mean, do you think in private they genuinely think, actually, this is good news for the sector, Gove coming back? Or are they just saying all the formalities in public that they have to say for political reasons?
I spoke to Ben Bradley, who's the leader of Nottinghamshire County Council and the MP for Mansfield, and he said that while he's really pleased that Michael Gove is back, he was actually quite disappointed that Simon Clark had gone. I think because he'd proved to be quite sort of instrumental on the East Midlands County deal, and I think Ben Bradley was just saying, you know, he didn't think Simon Clark had put a foot wrong, and Ben Bradley might not be the only person who thinks that, but I think broadly the sector is, even behind closed doors, will be welcoming Michael Gove back because, yeah, again, it is just that continuity.
You talked earlier about, you know, Michael Gove's back. He was the author of the Levelling Up white paper, but you mentioned obviously the economic situation. Mm. The context is much different now. I mean, do you have any sense or speculation? I mean, is this the same Levelling Up agenda as it was, say, 6 months ago? Or do you think we'll see something different with a new Prime Minister and the same Secretary of State?
Yeah, I don't know. I think one thing that Keir Starmer pulled the Prime Minister up yesterday on in PMQs was comments he'd made during the summer about sort of redistributing funding that through funding formulas set by Labour from poorer, deprived urban areas to rural areas. And now it's not clear what sort of funding formulas the Prime Minister was talking about there, but you know, even if he was talking about things like the Levelling Up Fund, that is a competitive bidding process, so but if he was talking about, you know, the way that we allocate funding to local government in terms of the financial settlement. Local government has been pushing for a really long time for a fair funding review. So I think, you know, I don't want to read too much into Rishi Sunak's comments, but I do think that if that's his attitude to levelling up, we could see a slight shift in it. And I think, yeah, the financial situation, you know, Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, has been very honest about there needing to be cuts to be made. And
I get the impression that Rishi Sunak is a lot less of a interventionist Prime Minister than Boris Johnson. You know, Boris said he was, you know, a Brexity hezer. I imagine Sunak's instinct wouldn't be to intervene as much in the economy. And with the economic situation, that probably just reinforced that trend.
Yeah, although it is interesting because Rishi Sunak's kind of baptism of fire was the furlough scheme, and that was a big intervention in the economy. So I think he has it in him, but it's whether that was pushing him out of his comfort zone and now he's back into it. He can, and obviously in the role of Prime Minister, he has a bit more autonomy over what decisions are made to do with the public finances. And really interesting times, but I'm glad that things have kind of calmed down and we've got a bit more certainty about who's going to be taking us through that. So
I think that itself is something. And no doubt next time we'll be talking about investment zones, because we're hearing rumours but we don't know anything definite.
Yeah.
So we'll watch that space. Moving on now, I've actually had a chat with our colleague Kirsty about an investigation I did into multi-academy trusts and councils. So should we listen to that?
Hello, right. I'm Kirsty Weekly and I'm joined by Martin George. We're taking a quick break to talk about one of our longer term investigations on LGC. Martin spent a good deal of the summer and autumn looking into multi-academy trusts. So do you want to start by explaining what they are and why councils should care about them?
Yeah, good question. So multi-academy trusts have been around for a long time. They're basically groups of schools that have become academies, so severed most of their links with councils. And instead of being directly accountable to their council, they're part of a charitable organisation that has a cluster of schools. They could be very local, they can be nationwide, they can be very small, they can be ones with dozens and dozens of schools in them. But it's an important question because the government wants all schools to be in a good multi-academy trust or join in one by 2030.
So not that long away, really.
Well, it depends how you measure time, I guess. I mean, that could be an endless number of education secretaries away, couldn't it?
True. So why did you choose now to get on with this investigation?
Well, it all sprang from the education white paper earlier this year, where the government said that for the first time councils would be allowed to set up multi-academy trusts. And fast forward to the LGA conference in June, lots of council chiefs were really interested to know, what are their peers doing? Are other councils looking at setting these up? How will they go about it? So I really thought, instead of having little bits of information here and there, let's contact all 150-odd councils in England and Wales, get a really comprehensive picture of who's going for it, who's not, who thinks that 2030 target is achievable in their area.
Yes, and no, not a small project then, getting hold of 150.
Yeah, it's never a burden having to chase responses from all these councils. In the end, about two-thirds replied. But I've got to say, it does take quite a few follow-up emails and even follow-up phone calls just to get to that point. So, yeah, I do always look back at the Nolan principles of openness and transparency, but I won't have my moan about that today, Kirsty.
No. So what were your sort of main findings from this?
So a big finding, we know that the government wants to meet that 2030 target. Only about a third or so of councils think that that is achievable in their area for all schools to be converted. About a quarter said it wasn't achievable or would be very challenging. A lot more said they just simply didn't know. And a lot actually said, nothing to do with us, it's up to individual schools whether they want to convert or not. So when the government says all schools in a good multi-academy trust by 2030, it looks very, very unlikely, I think.
Yeah. And were there any surprises that you came across in your research?
Yeah, I mean, so one thing I looked at was which councils have applied to take part in this government pilot scheme to sort of see proof of concept of councils setting up an academy trust, We knew 29 had expressed an interest. I managed to identify 17 of those. It was interesting, for example, Bexley in London have applied to take part in the pilot, even though they've actually got something like 80% of their schools already academised. There are also some councils that I know are enthusiastic about setting up a multi-academy trust potentially, like Essex. They hadn't actually applied to take part in this scheme. A lot of councils really were saying, we want to wait and see. We want to wait and see, will this tackle the issue of, you know, isolated rural schools, schools with big deficits, things like that.
Yeah.
And even good schools that have so far held out and chosen not to convert. So I think a lot of councils really want to see what these pioneers make of it.
So do you have any predictions for who might be first?
Good question. It's hard to know. The government want a big range of different geographical contexts, urban, rural, north, south, east and west. I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere like Hampshire was looked upon pretty favourably and maybe was, you know, one of the few councils to pilot this. No doubt there'll have to be some councils in more red wall areas. I don't know if we're looking at Sunderland, perhaps. How about this? North Yorkshire County Council, home of one Rishi Sunak. Maybe they'll be successful in their bid. Who knows?
I'm sure he's not directly involved in the bidding process.
I'm very sure of that as well, yeah.
And so what's your sort of takeaway about whether a sort of sensible approach is being followed across the country?
It's difficult to say. I think local context matters hugely here. So some councils, because of their political control, I think, really don't want to go down this route of academisation. I know Leeds said that even if the government did give them the power to issue academy orders, they just wouldn't do it. Again, ideological opposition from somewhere like Brighton and Hove. Other councils taking a more pragmatic approach, saying we'll look into it, we'll see. Some saying we'll do whatever the government wants us to do, basically, and we're starting to incorporate that 2030 ambition into their existing plans. But it really does vary from place to place.
And so having started this conversation by saying we're taking a break from the latest breaking news cycle, we can't finish without talking about one Rishi Sunak, who has just taken charge at Downing Street. What do you think his priorities might be in this area?
It's an interesting question. I mean, he's obviously known as an economics politician rather than education politician, but he did talk about better schools in his address in Downing Street.
A radical idea.
It's good to know that he doesn't want worse schools. I think that's reassured a lot of people.
Yeah.
And also the fact that he committed to the 2019 manifesto, Levelling Up in particular. Now, we know that the Levelling Up white paper talked about the DfE supporting strong multi-academy trusts to expand, particularly in these 55 education investment areas. Now, Rishi Sunak said he committed to Levelling Up. He's put Michael Gove, who brought forward the white paper, back into the Levelling Up brief. And we know Michael Gove was a absolutely fanatical proponent of academies when he was at the DfE, you know, a decade or so ago. So my understanding, my expectation at least, is that, yeah, the government will in one form or another still very much pursue this academisation agenda.
Yeah, well, it's definitely still on the agenda, and the feature is a really really good read. I certainly learned a lot when I was reading it through a couple of weeks ago. It's available online and in the latest issue of LGC magazine.
So right, we're back live with Megan. Megan, you've been looking at a really critical Select Committee report about exempt accommodation today.
Yeah, so I have been looking into a report by the Levelling Up Housing and Communities Select Committee into our exempt accommodation system. So exempt accommodation is accommodation which is exempt from housing benefit caps, so it can provide supported accommodation to people like prison leavers, care leavers, those fleeing domestic violence, and people who've fallen into homelessness who have substance dependence or mental health issues. So this report was pretty damning. I have to say it was one of the most shocking reports I've read from the Select Committee in my time at LGC. And it described the system as a complete mess, which I think is pretty damning. It basically found that some residents' experience of exempt accommodation is beyond disgraceful and has actually had a big effect on their health and well-being. For example, some people's health and well-being has actually deteriorated as a result of the conditions in which they live. You know, some examples in the report described people living with vermin, sort of exempt accommodation clusters, attracting antisocial behaviour and crime. And actually, you know, for me personally, the most shocking thing of all was in some exempt accommodation blocks, people who have fled domestic abuse are having to live with people who either were abusers themselves or are having to live in mixed-sex accommodation, which I think that some of the examples in the report were really quite shocking. So I'd really recommend going and reading it or reading my story on it. The report recommends that because at the moment the regulation of exempt accommodation is kind of, it's not standardised across the whole sector, so there's lots of different regulators, but some providers don't fall under any regulator.
I think that's the bit that surprised me the most and worried me, the idea of those gaps, a patchwork system, but gaps within that system being exploited by, was this where the organised criminal gangs laundering money came into it? I mean,
I think something that the report makes really clear is that it's taxpayers' money, because this is housing benefit which is going to pay for the accommodation that that people are being put into, which is then we're paying for accommodation which isn't up to standard. So the committee has recommended that there is a standardised regulator for exempt accommodation to stop this from happening. Yeah, and it's we've heard this kind of message time and time and again, but councils have said, and they said in the evidence, that a lack of powers and funding has held them back from being able to do more to solve this problem, which is a really big one. I think, you know, the committee's use of language says it all. If it's a complete mess, you know, it's definitely something that needs to be fixed.
I mean, I guess some of the comments from Clive Bett, the chair, was excess profits, gold rush paid for by taxpayers, shocking. You know, it shows the seriousness of this one. So,
yeah.
Was the government given it a year to come back with its national standards?
So. Yeah. And I think, you know, the fact that the government has tried to solve this issue, and I think during the evidence given to the committee, Eddie Hughes kind of pointed to sort of funding that the government was providing, but that funding itself was actually given out through a competitive bidding process, which, you know, if this is a problem across the country that's affecting people who are the most vulnerable in our society, then it doesn't really make sense to make it a competitive bidding process, because by default that will mean some places will lose out. And I think with an issue as grave as this, that's not really suitable, to be honest. So I would really recommend giving this report a read. It is pretty shocking.
And finally, a bit of good news for once. So we've talked about financial pressures on the sector and the wider public sector. One bit of local government's done quite well this week is the local government pension scheme. The overall market value actually increased by 8%. And here's the bit that really might be interesting to people. You say Croydon, you think of all the problems they've had, the financial black holes and so on. Mm-hmm. Actually, Croydon Council's pension fund had the biggest increase in value across the country, 12.4%.
Wow, that is good news, I suppose.
Yeah. Great. Well, Megan, thanks so much. Been really good talking to you. And no doubt we'll see you all next week.